Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good evening and welcome to Cure Talk. I'm Shweta Mishra, your host, joining you from India. And this evening on Cure Talk's 127th episode, we are discussing high-risk pregnancies, its causes, challenges, and care. A pregnancy is considered high-risk when there are potential complications that could affect the mother, the baby, or both. A high-risk pregnancy can be life-threatening to the mother as well as baby and therefore requires management by a specialist. In the developed world, the U.S. has the worst rate of maternal death, 60% of which are preventable. So proper attention and immediate care are equally important for both the mother and the baby. Moreover, women must be well-trained to tell when they need medical attention themselves during the pregnancy as well as few days after delivery, in addition to the baby care training they receive. Today, we are talking to Dr. Shannon Clark, a double board certified OBGYN and maternal fetal medicine specialist, about who falls in the high-risk category, about the challenges and experience involved in a high-risk pregnancy, and the care that is available. On our earlier shows, we have discussed topics like social egg freezing, risk factors of infertility, fertility preservation in cancer survivors, and emotional aspects of infertility with our knowledgeable experts like Dr. Amy, Dr. Jamin Brahmabhat, Dr. Richard Paulson, Dr. Kristen Brendixen, and psychotherapist Helen Edrian. Our expert today, Dr. Shannon M. Clark, is heavily involved in the care of women with maternal and fetal complications of pregnancy. She's an associate professor with roles as clinician, researcher, and educator at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. Her research interests include pharmacology of drugs, nausea, vomiting, and smoking in pregnancy, and she has published multiple peer-reviewed articles and is also a reviewer for numerous medical journals. She is actively involved in educating and training medical students. Dr. Clark has contributed to multiple hot topics of interest for pregnancy-related magazines, websites, and blogs. Inspired by not only the experiences of her friends and patients, but also by her own personal experiences, she has recently taken special interest in pregnancy after the age of 35. I welcome you to Cure Talks, Dr. Clark.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. And on the panel, we have with us Alia Page, who is the author of her blog, Expiration Date. Alia is a speaker and blogger working to educate women regarding their limited reproductive lifespan and how to beat their expiration date. Alia and her friends who have personal experience with assisted reproductive technology procedures and selecting a fertility center started this blog to provide easy-to-understand info about preserving female fertility. They guide couples in managing their fertility journey with their job and family and aim to educate people from the girlfriend's perspective. We also have with us Sally Cooney, also known as Gray-Haired Mom. And in her own words, literally a gray-haired mom, she gave birth at 51 to her only son through donor egg IVF treatment. Since 2011, she has written her blog, grayhairedmom.com, to share her experiences as an IVF patient, an older pregnant woman, and a geriatric new mom. And she has been completely thrilled to have been contacted by many other hopeful gray-haired moms to hear their stories. She lives with her husband and her now 6-year-old wonder of joy in New York City. I welcome you both to the show, Alia and Sally. I extend a hearty welcome to all our listeners, and I would like to remind our listeners that we will be discussing questions sent in via email at the end of the show. So you can send your questions to priya@trialx.com, and if you would like to ask a question live, please press 1 on your keypads and we'll bring you on air to ask them. Or you can directly post your questions on Cure Talk's website as you listen to the show. With this, let's start this discussion, Dr. Clark, by educating our audience by educating them about how is high-risk pregnancy defined, who is at risk, and what are the most common reasons that put pregnant women in high-risk category.
Yes, thank you. So as you previously mentioned in your introduction, a high-risk pregnancy is basically defined in simplest terms as a pregnancy where either the mother or the fetus have a complication that may require additional testing, surveillance, or any intervention in order to better manage the pregnancy for a more successful outcome. And anyone can become high-risk. not everyone enters the pregnancy as high risk. Many women do for multiple reasons. But an otherwise normal pregnancy can become high risk because of a development of any number of complications during the pregnancy. The most common reasons for a pregnancy to be labeled high risk are actually medical conditions that the mom might have before entering the pregnancy. For example, diabetes, chronic hypertension, pre-existing renal disease, and maybe even on renal dialysis, lupus, thyroid diseases, those are just some of the more common medical conditions we see that a woman may have at any age, actually, before entering the pregnancy. It's particularly more high risk if these conditions are not optimally controlled prior to pregnancy. So sometimes these conditions need to have better, more attention paid on entry to care because they're not optimally controlled. And in that case, the pregnancy would be at slightly more high risk status at that point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for your answer, Doctor. And at this point, I will now hand over the discussion to Alia Page, who is hosting the show with me. Alia, are you there?
Thanks so much, Sweeta. I really appreciate it. Dr. Clark, I'm so excited to talk to you today. I was 42 years old when I became pregnant with my twin daughters. We had grappled with infertility for 2 years prior to being able to become pregnant with our twin daughters, and it was just a really exciting time. However, I'd also had fibroid surgery, so I fell into that high-risk category of being advanced maternal age, becoming mm-hmm. pregnant with twins, and then having previous abdominal surgery. So pretty much I was in our local MFM office once a month up until a certain point where I think I went every couple of weeks for a little while there until I was released at 36 weeks. I was lucky enough to make it to 38 weeks, excitingly. Okay. So one of the things that I know that they were always kind of trying to keep an eye on or counseling me about was preeclampsia and just kind of mm-hmm. being on the watch out for that. What I understand is that there is an increased risk of preeclampsia, especially in African-American women who are advanced maternal age. I just was wondering, what is the cause of that?
Well, you're right. So there is an increased risk of preeclampsia in African-American women of any age, but also in women who are advanced maternal age. So an African-American woman who has advanced maternal age does have that increased risk there. We don't know a cause. There's nothing in any of the studies that says this is what causes or makes African-American women at increased risk, or this one answer makes her at increased risk for preeclampsia or any of the hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. But we do know there's several contributing factors. The one that's probably the most important is the higher incidence of comorbidities amongst African-American women that make them increased risk, which would include pre-existing hypertension that may or may not be well controlled, diabetes, obesity, acute renal failure or any history of renal disease in the past prior to pregnancy. And it can also include chronic renal failure. We also know that there can be some genetic differences that can predispose African-American women to higher risk for hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. And then you also have to look at some of the socioeconomic factors and disparities in the socioeconomic status of the African-American women. And then finally, a couple of other things would be limited access to health care, and then some limited awareness, depending on where the woman is seeking care, amongst practitioners or OBGYNs who are taking care of women who are African-American and not necessarily recognizing that they are at particularly high risk for developing hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. So there's multiple factors at play, but any time we have an African-American woman who has any pre-existing medical condition that would place her at further increased risk, that does make her at high risk for pregnancy for sure.
Well, I guess I'm one of those lucky people that received some really great care because that was identified pretty early on that was something that I had to, that they also had to keep an eye on. So I'm glad to see that. That's probably why I was also able to make it to 38 weeks as well.
Exactly.
You know, mm-hmm. since more and more women are having children over 35, what can women do to prepare mm-hmm. themselves physically for pregnancy over 35?
So, you know, this is a great question because I get this asked a lot of myself. I'm sure you do too. But I kind of narrowed it down to five things that I think are the most important to any woman who is anticipating delaying childbearing after age 35. The first is to, at some point in late 20s, early 30s, assess her fertility. That means have a conversation with her OBGYN, and there is a test called the AMH that can test for ovarian reserve that she can get ideally done in her late 20s, but can be done in the early 30s as well, just to see what her ovarian reserve is. The second thing would be, and this may not necessarily go with what she can physically do to prepare for pregnancy after 35, but if a woman knows she is going to wait, she should consider freezing her eggs as soon as possible, and the optimal time for that would be in the late 20s. And then number three thing that I tell women is, if there are any pre-existing medical diseases that she may have, get them optimally controlled prior to getting pregnant. And these things, diseases could be diabetes, high blood pressure, lupus, thyroid disease, obesity, anything that may not be well controlled, get that under control prior to becoming pregnant. And the final two things, there's what I tell any pregnant woman, but particularly women, or any woman who is planning pregnancy, but particularly women over age 35, would be to maintain a healthy weight, and then just exercise and eat a balanced diet. You know, just take care of your body for as long as possible before attempting pregnancy after age 35. So those are the five most important things that I think women should know.
That's interesting. We talk about this a lot on our website, expiration date, how
yes.
important it is, because this is the whole concept is maybe you don't even know that you're going to anticipate delaying
mm-hmm.
childbearing. You know, for a lot of us, you just kind of look up and you realize, oh, wow, you know,
yeah.
I'm 36, I haven't had kids yet, may or may not be in that relationship where you're prepared or married, where you're prepared
right.
to go ahead and have children. And so I think that it's really interesting that you mentioned these five things, which we actually talk about a lot as well, to do these almost on a preventative basis, because you just never know, you know, where you, when, how old you are going to be, and you know, when you will have children, when it's going to be the right time for you. So I could not agree more with, you know, those five sort of tenets of preparing
right.
yourself to have a child, because you just don't know if it's going to be when you're, you know, advanced maternal age, and then at that point trying to freeze eggs is really very challenging at that point, obviously.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Are there any improvements that will help to reduce multiples in women who take advantage of infertility procedures like myself? And we didn't go into this thinking, hey, we want to have multiples. But, you know,
right.
we ultimately tried, you know, several different procedures, and ultimately IUI worked for us. We were able to become
okay.
pregnant. And so are there any improvements that can help to reduce multiples, you know, moving forward? I'm not sure if IUI falls into that category, but maybe, I don't know, with IVF?
So, you know, there are different types, forms of infertility treatments, and it's all fall underneath the category of ART, or assisted reproductive technology. IVF is the kind of the, I guess, the most popular one that everybody refers to, but you spoke of intrauterine insemination. There's, you know, ovulation induction with intrauterine insemination, or IUI. So there's different levels that you can do, but IVF would be where we retrieve the eggs and the sperm outside of the body and then put them together in outside of the body to be transferred back in. So basically, the easiest way to kind of separate the two is that the two forms is that the number of embryos that can be transferred during an IVF cycle can be controlled. So the physician or the infertility specialist knows exactly how many embryos they put back into the woman's uterus during a cycle of IVF. And the current guidelines by ASRM recommend a single embryo transfer with IVF at this time. But these guidelines are not, again, these are just guidelines. So not all fertility centers do a single embryo transfer, although it is recommended and it is a guideline. But there are also circumstances where the transfer of one or more embryo may be done. And that could be after multiple failed embryo transfers or untested embryos in someone over age 40. And then the number of embryos that can be potentially developed cannot be controlled with the number of embryos that can develop with ovulation induction or IUI cannot be controlled. And that's like when you use Clomid or ovulation induction with IUI. And as a result, a lot of these cases where you hear of the higher order multiples, you know, four, five, and six babies in a pregnancy, that's usually from ovulation induction rather than IVF, because the number of babies that develop with ovulation induction cannot be controlled, whereas you can control the number of embryos placed during IUI or IVF. Does that kind of make sense? So, you know, if a woman does get pregnant with multiples, with higher order multiples, it's more likely from ovulation induction rather than IVF.
Oh, that makes all the sense in the world. I really appreciate
right.
that, Doc. Sally, it's your turn. What questions do you mm-hmm. have for Dr. Clark?
Hi. Thank you so much for having me today. It's great to be here. Dr. Clark, I had recently read a report that was published by ProPublica and NPR about the maternal death rate in the United States, and it was just totally appalling. We have the highest maternal death rate of any developed nation in the world, and 60% of these deaths are labeled as preventable. What, in your opinion, is contributing to this alarming trend?
Yeah, you know, this has been presented in the media much more frequently and more recently. And yes, it is alarming and it is very scary. And I do get a lot of questions about this, so I'm glad this is something we're going to discuss. You know, as a high-risk physician or a maternal fetal medicine specialist, there are mainly, I would say, four reasons that I would attribute, and not only myself but my colleagues as well, to why we see this trend. The first one is that we're seeing a lot more patients who are older. And older women having babies, you know, can have more pre-existing medical conditions like obesity, diabetes, hypertension, any of the other things that I mentioned previously or earlier in this conversation. So older women do have more medical issues, largely. And then also along the same lines, advances in ART with IVF and other forms of assisted reproductive technology have allowed more older women to become mothers. So, you know, that kind of goes hand in hand. The next reason is that we are seeing a lot of more obesity in our pregnant women and women delivering, which, you know, and I'm not just talking about, you know, slightly overweight. I'm talking about morbid obesity. And those pregnancies are complicated, not only the pregnancy but the delivery as well. Next, we're going to see more pre-existing medical issues. And like I mentioned with the first, talking about older women, just any woman coming at any age with uncontrolled diabetes, uncontrolled renal disease, uncontrolled hypertension, that makes a pregnancy very complicated. And when the woman comes in pregnant, she may or may not have planned this pregnancy. Her disease may or may not be well controlled. We're playing catch up, and we're trying to get this disease under control while she's pregnant, which makes it a lot of times even harder to get things under control. So those, the first three things, are a lot of the reasons why we're seeing this trend. And then, you know, let's talk. One of the things they talked about in this article, which I did read, and I thank you for providing that to me, is that the focus on the neonate is rightfully so. Yes, we need to focus on having a healthy baby. But a lot of times we don't focus on the mom, either during the pregnancy or afterwards as well in the postpartum period. And it's called maternal fetal medicine for a reason. It's not just fetal medicine. The mom is just as important as a fetus. A healthy mom is needed for a healthy baby. So we do need to make sure we always pay attention to mom and mom's health just as, and be invested in that just as much as we are invested in the outcome of the fetus and having a healthy baby. And unfortunately, across the nation, not all centers have access to maternal fetal medicine specialists. And a lot of places and counties and cities in the United States are far away from even an OBGYN, and women are having to travel far away just to get basic obstetric care. So that's part of the issue as well. So those are the four main reasons why I think that we're seeing this trend.
You know, I'd like to follow up on that. So the trend for older women and the advances in ART in the United States being part of the reason that there's a larger pool of, you know, older women, which may contribute to the higher rate of death among mothers, wouldn't that also exist in the other developed countries?
Well, I mean, it depends. Not all countries have the same rate. You know, I don't know that the United States is any higher. That might be a question that's better suited for an REI, as far as how many cycles we do and how prevalent it is. But yes, that could be a factor. But in the United States in particular, we are seeing a huge increase in the number of older women getting pregnant over the past several years. It's just like the CDC put out some recent data about the decrease in pregnancy rates among younger women and the increase in pregnancy rates among older women. And a large reason for that is because of infertility treatments and ART. So yes, you know, that would be great to look at that data and compare internationally. I don't know that that's being done, but that would be a great source of information and a great area of research to be, to be considered in the future, for sure.
Thank you. You know, when I contacted my maternal fetal medicine practice in New York, so I felt just very privileged to live in an area where I had access to some of the greatest doctors in the country. My doctor was Dr. Kirsten Cleary at New York Presbyterian, And I was 50 years old and carrying twins at 10 weeks when I called the practice. And her wonderful nurse practitioner who answered the phone said, okay, well, you're 50 and pregnant with twins, but what's your high risk? So is age necessarily in and of itself a high risk? Do you define just, somebody over 50 or over 45 as being high risk, or are there other mitigating factors?
I think, just based on age alone, do we normally see 50-year-olds becoming pregnant? No. So that definitely would get our attention. But an otherwise healthy pregnant woman at age 50 with no uncontrolled pre-existing medical conditions would not necessarily be considered high risk unless there's something else, possibly, antenatal screening that showed that the pregnancy was at high risk for a chromosomal defect or anything else like that that would make the pregnancy high risk. But just based on age alone, if everything else is, under control and she has no serious medical conditions and the pregnancy screening testing has all been negative, she should expect to have a completely normal pregnancy as someone who is younger than her. So just age alone wouldn't necessarily make a woman high risk.
Also, as a woman who gave birth at 51 and, fortunately to a healthy full-term baby and with a pretty much uneventful pregnancy, I felt very lucky. But I also have to feel that part of it was that I had such good insurance and I had access to, a pool of wonderful doctors. But I also have friends who were much younger, not considered geriatric mothers to be, had no obvious pre-pregnancy health factors, who almost died in childbirth. From my perspective, which is, of course, anecdotal, the differentiating factor with these younger women seemed to be insurance, having insurance. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how and if you feel constrained by insurance companies or other regulations in providing the treatment that you feel is necessary.
Okay, so I want to explain a little bit about how the practice where I'm at. I basically work in an academic center, and our patient population predominantly consists of patients who receive Medicaid and other forms of federal or state-funded health insurance programs. And so based on what form of funding our patients have, the federal or state funding, there are some constraints on getting the patient seen by other specialties if needed. For example, if she has a seizure disorder and we need her to see neurology, or she has a pre-existing heart condition and may need to see cardiology or have a consult, there may be some constraints on getting those referrals if the patient needs it, just based on what form of state-funded health insurance program she has. Excuse me. But overall, we do try to get as much as we can for the patient and do what we need to do, even if it is at the cost of the hospital. Now, that's going to vary across the nation. It's going to vary between state to state because not all state-funded health insurance programs are the same. It varies from state to state. So any woman who doesn't make enough money to qualify for full Medicaid but makes too much money to qualify for full Medicaid and doesn't make quite enough to qualify for other levels, each level of state or federally funded health insurance programs are going to offer different levels of care as far as what will be reimbursed. So, I'm sure that is a factor to some degree. Now, whether or not this particular way that our state and federal funded health insurance programs run have an impact on that, that need should be looked at and can be looked at. That'd be another great source of research in that area. There's so many areas, I'll just digress for a minute, there's so many areas in obstetric and maternal care that would be benefit from more research, and I just can't even name everything, but, this would be another area to look at. But for sure, I think, the level of care and also the access to care depending on where women live. I mentioned before, where they live which state they live in, where they live within each state, their care or access to care may be limited just based on where they are geographically. So those are all factors at play. I don't know the particular circumstance of the people you're speaking of, but, I'd be curious to see exactly, how much that played a role in their care.
Right. No. And, there are different cases with, different one of these women that I know, but most of it did, you know, really center on whether they had access to private insurance or not, and what level of coverage they had access to. You know, and I, at my age, I've been lucky enough to have my one and only child. So I've only experienced being a patient in a high-risk maternity practice. Could you talk a little bit about the differences the patient can expect, like maybe a woman who has previously had a, you know, quote-unquote normal pregnancy and is now entering into a high-risk pregnancy?
So you're asking me the differences the patient can expect if she's considered high-risk?
Yes, like in your practice, what differences from maybe a you know, normal level of care compared to a high risk level of care?
That's largely going to depend on which complication or complications she has, whether it's a maternal complication or a fetal complication. So that kind of all depends on what complications are at play. But overall, she may require more frequent visits to her OBGYN and or maternal fetal medicine specialist. There may be a need for increased fetal surveillance with a non-stress test or ultrasounds or biophysical profiles or anything like that. She may require a planned delivery, meaning a planned C-section or induction versus allowing herself to go into labor spontaneously, depending on what the complication is. She may require an early delivery based on what the complication is. And she also may require medical treatment with medications or any other procedures in order to control her medical condition if there is something at play. So, again, there's different levels of high risk. A woman who comes in, I'll just give you an example. On the high risk spectrum, a little bit lower on the high risk spectrum would be someone that comes in with diabetes or blood pressure that's well controlled, who may or may not even require additional medications or any medication in her pregnancy because she's under control. Then I have patients who are on the higher end who have had a renal transplant, who have a renal transplant plus diabetes, plus hypertension, and they're pregnant, and they may have multiples. So, you know, the variations for calling someone high risk or labeling a pregnancy high risk, you know, there is definitely a spectrum there. So high risk is not necessarily meant to scare people. Because they're being called high risk, you know, if anything, it's to make sure that they are kind of flagged as someone to pay extra attention to and extra care to be taken throughout their pregnancy, and that they're on our radar, if you will, for lack of a better word, as someone who could be at increased risk for having potential additional complications in her pregnancy based on the fact that she may have diabetes or may have hypertension, whether it's controlled or not. So I want to make sure that we focus on the fact that, you know, if you go into your doctor's office and they say, oh, you're high risk, that doesn't mean that you're going to have a complicated pregnancy and a bad outcome or, you know, a difficult delivery. That just means that there's something about you and or your baby that is requiring more attention, as opposed to someone who is really high on the high risk spectrum and they know that, you know, they're getting dialysis 5 days a week. Of course, that pregnancy is definitely going to be on the higher risk spectrum and definitely will require more interventions and treatments and care for someone like that.
Great. And so during a pregnancy, can the assessment of high risk change? Can a patient suddenly not be classified as high risk and return to a normal OBGYN?
I'm trying to think. So when we see patients as a high-risk specialist, we could see them one of two ways. Either their general OBGYN feels that the complications or condition of either the mom and or the fetus warrants that they require continual care by a high-risk obstetrician, and they will release that patient to a high-risk obstetrician to receive the rest of their care. Or they want the patient to see a maternal fetal medicine specialist or high-risk specialist for just a consult to get some recommendations on how to manage their thyroid disease or their diabetes or their high blood pressure, but they do remain with their general OBGYN for the care and just periodically will see someone like myself just as a consult and make sure that the management is going as planned. But, you know, yes, can someone be considered high-risk and then by their general OBGYN and then come to me and I say, you know what, this reason is actually no longer at play, so she can go back to her normal OBGYN and continue as a low-risk patient. Yes, that happens quite frequently. And basically, in a circumstance like that, the patient will come into her general OBGYN and have a history of maybe an abnormal heart rate accessory pathway in her heart being ablated. Okay, she has that medical history that was done, so then she comes to see me to make sure there's nothing that we need to do special in her pregnancy. And I say, no, she's good, her heart's good, she can go back to a low risk. Or someone like myself, I had a heart defect that was repaired, a congenital heart defect that was repaired when I was 8. So, you know, say I'm not an OBGYN and I don't know any better, then say my OBGYN may have sent me to a high-risk specialist to say, hey, this patient had heart surgery when she was a child. Are there any factors at play that can make her pregnancy more complicated? The high-risk doctor would have said, no, this problem has been corrected, so no, she's not high risk. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, so yeah, it all depends. Not every woman who's labeled at high risk initially will actually end up being high risk the rest of their pregnancy, depending on what the particular condition is.
Right. During my pregnancy, you know, one of my biggest problems, I think, was that I was experiencing stress at work. And the stress became so bad that I actually had to see a therapist for the first time really in my life to help deal with the stress. Mm-hmm. I've been reading a lot recently about the adverse effects of this kind of, you know, heavy-duty psychological stress on a pregnant woman and her unborn child. I'd just like to hear your opinion about not only dealing with stress during a high-risk pregnancy, but the risks and if there are any benefits in continuing or taking antidepressant or anti-anxiety medications during pregnancy?
So that's a great question. I want to first start off by saying that having a healthy mom is necessary. A physically and mentally healthy mom is necessary for a healthy pregnancy to progress. We have women who come in with a history of having depression and anxiety who were on medications, they get pregnant, they stop their medications, and are scared to take anything, and rightfully so. I would be scared too. I mean, we are, you know, it's our nature to protect our babies and not want to expose them to anything that could potentially harm them, and I totally understand that. But then their anxiety and depression just go off the rails when they're pregnant and or postpartum, and that's not healthy for the pregnancy either. So in a situation like that, we have to weigh the risk-benefit ratio, and we need to sit down and talk to our patients and say, hey, this is what we recommend. We do recommend that you go back onto your medications, or we recommend that you continue them. Or, let's digress here for a second. The options may be continue your medications, don't ever come off of them. Number two, restart the medications if the patient's already come off on her own, because a lot of patients will self-discontinue any antidepressants or anti-anxiety meds once they found out they're pregnant. Or number three, if the patient is doing okay, she may wait until after the first trimester to restart her medications. That's only going to be decided based on a conversation between the OBGYN, the patient, and the patient's therapist, if there is one, or psychiatrist or psychologist who is involved in her care if she has one. So that is a group effort, okay? And sometimes we recommend stay on your meds. And sometimes I say, you know what, you're doing okay. Let's come off the meds for the first trimester and then restart them. And then there's times during pregnancy where someone has new onset depression or anxiety, and I will say, we need to put you on something and based on her symptoms. Because at the end of the day, if you have a stressed out, depressed and or depressed mom during her pregnancy, that can be just as dangerous to the pregnancy as someone who is taking medications that may not be category A or category B, which is the kind of drugs that we want all of our pregnant patients to be on. So again, the risk-benefit ratio has to be looked at and has to be discussed, and then educated and the best decision made for that individual patient should be reached.
Great. Thank you so much, doctors.
Dr. Clark, thanks so much. You really have shed, just given us a lot of information on just a lot of these high-risk topics, and I really appreciate it. Shweta, I think you're up next.
Okay, yeah. Thank you so much, Alia. Dr. Clark, I was just wondering, have we reached to a reason as to why advanced maternal age puts the fetus at increased risk of genetic abnormalities like Down syndrome?
Well, it's pretty well known that the reason why that happens in women over, it starts to occur after age 35, has another sharp increase at age 37 to 38, and then drastically at age 40. And that's because of ovarian aging, and in particular, decreased egg quality, meaning that, in simplest words here, a woman is born with all the eggs she will ever have. So if she starts having babies at 20, those eggs have only been there for 20 years. If she starts having babies at age 42, like myself, my eggs were there for 42 years. And they don't like being there for that long. So the genetic material within those eggs can become dysfunctional. And when they are fertilized by a sperm, they don't either A, don't become fertilized, B, they become fertilized and develop a genetically abnormal embryo that may be something like Down syndrome or may result in a miscarriage in the first trimester, which happened to me as well. I did have ovarian aging and decreased egg quality. So that's the main reason why that risk of genetic abnormalities like Down syndrome occurs in a woman after age 35. But there is also, you know, more women less than 35 have, most babies that have Down syndrome are born to women less than age 35 because that's the group of women that are having more babies. But there is an increased risk for women after age 35 to have genetic abnormalities, and the most common one that we talk about is Down syndrome.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just wondering, does this also relate to the age of the father?
Paternal component as well, but that really doesn't start to occur until after age 55 or so. So there's a good 20-year difference between the maternal component and the paternal component, and that the most common things you think about are other genetic disorders like dwarfism, or something called Marfan syndrome. Those are two things that advanced paternal age are known to be associated with. But there are other things as well. With men who conceive much later in life.
Let's move on and talk about some of the anatomical abnormalities that can put a pregnant woman in the high-risk category, like abnormal shape of the uterus. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Like what?
Like the abnormal shape or the anatomical abnormalities.
Of a woman's uterus?
Of the uterus.
Yes. Well, so anytime you have any uterine anomaly, and there's a whole list of them, and there's actually a great diagram that you can Google online. If you just put in uterine anomalies and then Google images, you could see all the different ones. But one of the more common ones that may be attributed to recurrent miscarriage would be a uterine septum. And that's where you actually have an extra piece of tissue in the uterine cavity. So sometimes when women have multiple miscarriages early on, she may require a study that actually looks into the lining of her uterus to see if there's a uterine septum there. And if you take that uterine septum out, she can more often than not, she will conceive. There's other forms of uterine anomalies where you have a uterine didelphys or a bicornuate uterus or where the uterus is kind of divided in half, and so you get pregnant in one horn versus the other. So you don't have as big of a uterus to develop a baby in as you would if you just had the single developed, normally developed uterus. And in that situation, that does put you in increased risk for a few things. The first thing would be preterm labor and delivery. And the second thing would be fetal malpresentation, meaning like a breech presentation rather than having the baby head first. So those types of uterine anomalies can make the pregnancy high risk for those reasons.
Okay, and I read something about banana uterus. Can you talk a bit about that?
A uterine didelphys or uterine didelphys would be an example of that. If you look at the pictures online, that's kind of what it looks like. The uterus kind of gets shaped kind of like a banana. So I'm guessing. I haven't heard that, to be honest with you. I call it a banana uterus, but I'm guessing that's probably what they're referring to.
Okay. Right. So these people with abnormal shaped uterus, they don't have problems in conception, or do they?
Well, if they have like a uterine septum or bicornuate uterus or a heart shaped uterus or something like that, that can affect implantation into the uterine cavity because there is that piece of tissue that comes down into the uterine cavity that does not allow keep the the embryo from implanting. We also need to consider fibroids as well. There's different areas in the uterus that the fibroid can be located. And if you have a fibroid that's located deep inside the uterus and affects the uterine lining, then that can also affect implantation as well.
Okay. All right. Alia, do you have any more questions?
Yeah, Doc, while I was pregnant, I was around 24 weeks, what ended up happening was that my cervix shortened. It wasn't a drastic mm-hmm. amount. I believe it was a centimeter. I think it went from it was a 4, it was 3, and it was like 2 point, and I can't recall the exact measurement. But it was still, you know, decent in length, but they started to get a little nervous and then just decided to give me a pessary. And so it was really kind of a very interesting experience in that, you know, I work in a gynecology practice, so my understanding of a pessary was for elderly women. And so when they were talking about this pessary, I was just kind of, you know, horrified, to be honest with you, when I first heard about this. But, you know, ultimately I had the pessary from 24 weeks. I believe that they removed it at 36 weeks, and all was well. Can you talk a bit about some of the obstetrical pessaries and what their uses are?
Well, there's not really obstetrical pessaries. We do use the gynecologic pessaries, okay? So if we do place a pessary, that is what we use. And that can be used in for a shortened cervix. Now, we typically, the length of a cervix and what we are alarmed with is different for a singleton pregnancy versus a twin pregnancy. And just like you, well, I was pregnant with twins, and my cervix shortened to about 0.9 centimeters. And I was in the hospital for, and I was pregnant with twins, and I was in the hospital on bed rest for 2 months. So it depends on, you know, the length of your cervix, you know, at what gestational age and the pregnancy, the length of the cervix is diagnosed as to what the interventions can be. But actually there's a great study that's being conducted right now on the use of a pessary versus other forms of treatment or therapy for shortened cervix. But it's particularly looking at a pessary. So hopefully the results will be published within the next few years. but right now there's really not a whole lot out there saying that this is what this under this circumstance you put the pessary in versus something else. But the whole thought of it, why the pessary is supposed to work, is it's supposed to change the angle of the cervix where, for example, the cervix and the uterus should be kind of at an angle to where it could be a 90-degree angle, a 45-degree angle, as opposed to being directly in line with another. So the thought is that the pessary actually changes the angle of the cervix and kind of takes some pressure off the cervix and doesn't allow that direct communication between the lower uterine segment and the cervix because it puts that kind of angle back in there. So that's the thought of how the pessary works. And it is used, not used very commonly. It's probably used in different areas of the, you know, geographic areas of the nation as compared to others. I will say that I've never used it in my practice, but I know it is used in other centers. But that's kind of one of the reasons why we would use it. And it's just actually a GYN pessary is what we use.
And Doc, could you also describe this for any of our listeners that maybe have never even heard or have no clue what it looks like? Can you describe what it looks like as well?
So it's kind of like there's different types of pessaries that are used in gynecology. But it's kind of like it looks like a little round, hard donut I don't know how else to explain it, but you kind of slip it in behind the pubic bone, in front of the cervix, and it kind of just stays there. And then at some point in the pregnancy, usually around 36 or 37 weeks, if the pregnancy makes it that long, we'll take it out. But that's did you get to see what yours looked like?
Yeah, exactly what it looked like.
Yeah.
Like a donut, essentially. Yep.
It's not as big as a donut. It's probably about a third of that size, but it's like a round, hard donut is kind of what it looks like.
Yeah, with like an opening. And it just, you know, it was extremely, you know, it was very scary to go through it because, you know, obviously, and I got received some really wonderful counseling where they said, you know what, you know, there's, you know, studies that can, that say that, you know, this could be helpful, you know, it
right.
may not. But, you know,
right.
we think that it's worth placing it. And, you know, ultimately, who knows whether it helped or didn't, but I made it to 38 weeks. So, you know, we'll say that it helped.
Yeah,
we'll definitely say that it helped. I appreciate
that.
Yeah,
it's great
that
you brought that up because this study that we're doing is going to be a great study, and I'm anxious to see what the results are going to be. So,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. Back to you, Shweta.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Alia. Thank you. Sally, do you have any more questions to ask to Dr. Sarf?
I read a piece this morning in the New York Times by Dr. Alexandra Sachs she talks about the process of becoming a mother and anthropologists call the term matrescence, but that it's something that's largely unexplored in the medical community. And instead of focusing on how a woman's identity changes as she becomes a mother, most of the research is focused, of course, on how, you know, the baby turns out. And I just wonder if the doctor thinks, you know, in her own education, did she find this to be true, that the focus is more, you know, almost always on the baby and not so much about the woman and the woman becoming a mother? And also one other, I think the most shocking thing I've ever read about pregnancy is the fact that the number one killer of pregnant women is homicide. So maybe how as a society we have yet to address some very fundamental things such as, you know, violence against women and, you know, how that just impacts healthy mothers, healthy babies, and healthy families.
Yeah, so to answer your first question, if I'm right, you're wondering about whether or not I was, in my training, I was we were taught about the process of a woman transitioning from not being a mother to becoming a mother? Is that what you mean?
Yes. The Dr. Sachs refers to it as matrescence. Uh-huh. And it is the title of her article today in the New York Times was The Birth of a Mother. So it's the whole process of, you know, experiencing motherhood and going on to be a parent.
Yeah, I mean, were we ever taught about what it actually means mentally, physically, and spiritually for a woman to make that transition into motherhood? No. I will say that in my particular training, I very heavily trained as far as when you talk about maternal fetal medicine, MFM, where I trained and where I work, we are very heavily educated and work a lot with the maternal part. So that part, yes. But no, I mean, even in medical school, we're not really focused on learning about what it means for that transition. And that is probably showing up the greatest in the more recent decision that's been being paid, particularly by Allison Stubbe, in the what she calls the fourth trimester, which is after the postpartum period, and how women are, you know, kind of neglected during that period. And I will tell you from my own experience, I'm 8 months out, and I'm still having a hard time in a lot of respects. So do we get educated about how to deal with that with our patients? Not really. And do we need to? Absolutely. We need to be more educated and learn more about this and what that means for one to make that transition in all areas, like I said, mentally, physically, spiritually, in order to better take care of her. Because we see these women as OBGYNs throughout their entire life cycle, ideally, and we kind of just gloss over that part and wait till she finishes her childbearing and then goes on into menopause. But there's so much that happens in between. That we don't really have a lot of information or education on. So I do agree with that and that your point there. Now, as far as the violence and pregnant women being the victim of homicide, that is absolutely true. And you only hear about that sporadically in the news. I guess because, you know, if I had to guess, there's just not a whole lot of information out on that. As far as research and why this happens, but we do know that one of the most vulnerable times in a woman's life is when she's pregnant, as far as being a victim of violence and homicide. We do know that, but what do we do to fix it? You know, I'm not quite sure. But, you know, that is another area that for women's health care that is largely lacking in information and education.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry, I just wanted to say I do have to agree, probably. I have one of the greatest support systems, friends and family, and it is still probably one of the most isolating periods of your life. The day you come home and realize, you know, you get up the next morning and these mornings stretch out in front of you, and it seems to be almost endless, and it's, I think it's maybe something we need to talk about and support each other through, that, you know, you're not always going to feel like you're in a Pampers commercial. You're going to be, you know, facing challenges.
I just real quick, and then we'll stop here. I just want to make the point that, you know, with the availability of social media and all the things that go along with social media, the Twitters, the Facebook, the Instagram, everything that we have access to, the internet, you know, I'm really glad that a lot of women are being honest about what their experiences are, but we need to be more honest, and we need to be more willing to share, because all we really see is all the glamorous parts about it and see that this person's doing this perfect, and I look at that, and I'm like, oh, my God, I'm not doing that. Am I failing? You know, we need to know that it's normal to not do everything perfect and to support one another instead of tearing each other down, which I see that a lot just on social
right.
media. So, you know, I don't know how to fix that. All I know is what I do, both as a medical professional and as a woman who had donor egg twins at 43. You know, what I've done is I've chose to be transparent and share my journey and be honest. But I'm one person, and I can't fix everything, but we just need more of that. So I'm glad you brought that up, because I think it would be very helpful for other women going through the things that we've gone through.
Hear, hear. Thank you so much, Doctor, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Doctor, and thank you, Sally, for your questions. I think now I just have one more question before we move on to the listeners' questions. Dr. Clark, is there a difference in high-risk pregnancy rate between normal conception and conception by artificial reproductive technique?
I'm sorry, can you say it again?
Yeah, does any research show that there is a difference in high-risk pregnancy rate between normal conception and that by artificial reproductive technique?
Yeah, so there is some evidence that pregnancies mm-hmm. that result from ART are an increased risk for both antenatal and perinatal complications, but we're still not mm-hmm. really sure if this increased risk is because of the ART process itself, the higher mm-hmm. incidence of multiples that are associated with ART, or the fact that mm-hmm. the woman, most women who are undergoing ART are sub or mm-hmm. infertile, and is that what's causing the pregnancies to become more high risk. So we definitely need more research on that, although there has been some more recent publications that have actually shown that definitely may be the case. We do know, for example, that some pregnancies that are conceived by IVF some studies have shown that there's increased risk for diabetes, mm-hmm. hypertension, preeclampsia, and other morbidities in pregnancy. So definitely more research is needed on that.
Okay. But by default, all the conception that happens through ART techniques, those are not classified as high risk, right?
No. If you have if it's a multiples, then yes, I do firmly believe that anyone with a multiple pregnancy should be considered high risk. Does she need mm-hmm. to be scared? No. Does she need to have 24-hour care and by a higher specialist? No. But she does need more surveillance, and mm-hmm. so do the babies. But, you know, an otherwise normal pregnancy through IVF or ART, with no of the other things that we've previously talked about over the past hour, if she's otherwise healthy, then it should be a completely normal pregnancy.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you for that answer. And we have a couple of listeners' questions posted on our website. So the first one says, what is the true cause of miscarriage?
I wish I knew. And if anybody has any information on that,
yeah.
I'd be glad. I'd be happy to pay everything I have to know that. But, you know, there is no one cause. There are many mm-hmm. causes of miscarriage. There's genetic causes. There's medical diseases that a woman may have that may place her in increased risk for miscarriage, like uncontrolled diabetes, antiphospholipid antibody mm-hmm. syndrome. You know, there's you know, tons of other reasons. There's hormonal issues, obesity. A lifestyle, you know, smoking, drug use. I mean, I could go, the list goes on and on. So is there mm-hmm. one real cause? No. It's multiple causes. And, you know, if a woman is worried about her risk, she should definitely talk to her OBGYN about that, either before pregnancy or earlier on, to see if that risk is really there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. The other one asks, does having a retroverted uterus put me in high-risk category?
Sometimes having a severely retroverted uterus could cause some problems getting pregnant just by not allowing the sperm to reach the egg. I actually had a friend who had that problem, and they actually went in and kind of popped the uterus back, you know, from being retroverted mm-hmm. to a more normal position, and she was able to get pregnant. Now, there's sometimes women who have a severely retroverted uterus, and that just means that instead of the uterus kind of being in line with the body. It's kind of pointed back towards her bum or her rear end.
Okay.
And if the pregnancy progresses, it can get trapped behind the pubic bone, and we have to go in and kind of pop the uterus out. So I wouldn't necessarily consider it high risk, but it can be a little bit of a problem.
Okay. Okay, that's interesting to know that you can simply just pop back the uterus to a normal position. So
I've seen it a couple times. Yeah.
Okay, I'm just wondering what could be the reasons that our uterus becomes retroverted? Like, is it like the position of exercise
just,
or something?
No, it's just some uteruses are severely antiverted, meaning pointing towards the bladder, and there's some that are severely retroverted or pointed towards the rectum. And that's just anatomically how the woman was made. It's nothing that she did to do that. It's just her anatomy. And a lot of times earlier on when we do a pelvic exam, like that first pelvic exam that you do get as a teenager or a young female, we could tell on our exam where the position, that's one of the things we're required to document is the position of the uterus, whether it's midline, antiverted, retroverted, or anything like that. So we can tell on the bimanual exam whether or not a uterus is antiverted or retroverted.
Okay, that's interesting. Okay, then the last question that we have is, I have gestational diabetes. Do I fall in high-risk category? And any suggestions on how to manage exercise routine for people who are supposed to be on bed most of the time during pregnancy?
Okay, so what was the first part? She has gestational diabetes. Does that make her
high-risk?
She
has gestational. Yes, she asked that, yes.
So technically, yes, it makes her high-risk. But, you know, gestational diabetes is very common. The important thing is that she follow the dietary recommendations that have been put forth by her OBGYN. If she is on medication, that she take her medication, that she, you know, the baby will require a little bit of extra surveillance throughout the pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, gestational diabetes is common. That's why we look for it. And in some patient populations, we look for it twice, not just at the 24 to 28-week mark, but sometimes we do it on the entry to care as well if it's a high-risk patient population. So it's very common.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be scary unless it gets out of control and the sugars are getting out of control, which can happen. That's why we do more visits with our gestational diabetics. That's why we check the sugars more frequently and to make sure that the diabetes is under control. And what was the second question you had?
The second one was whether are there any suggestions? Can you give any suggestions on how to manage exercise routine for people who are supposed to be on bed? I mean, people who are on bed rest due to high risk.
Well, I was on bed rest too, and there's not a whole lot you can do. I just used to do calf kind of exercise my calves, but I will tell you, I was on bed rest for 2 months, and I lost all of my muscle mass, and I'm still trying to get it back. It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on why you're on bed rest will depend on, you know, how restricted you are on your bed rest, depends on how much physical activity you have. There's not a whole lot you can do. A lot of times if you're on a prolonged bed rest, you can get physical therapy or occupational therapy to come in and see you. Just to do some stretches and things like that, which, you know, you could do either in the hospital or on home bed rest if you have access to that. But other than that, it's really not possible if you're on, you know, being told to be put on a strict bed rest. It's not really possible to do a lot of physical activity, unfortunately.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much, Doctor. That was just a wonderful discussion and a very informative one. And I really thank you for all your time, sparing your busy time for us. Alia and Sally, I thank you for your questions and your very insightful thoughts on this issue of high-risk pregnancy. And I would like to thank my audience for your support, and we look forward to having you all join us for our next Cure Talks on novel technology to check male fertility status with Dr. Jamin Ramhat on July 15th. For more information on this show and other upcoming shows, please visit our website, www.curetalks.com. Or you can also email priya@trialx.com. The link for today's show will be sent in to all the participants via email. So until the next show, thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.